Okay, we start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning everyone.
Good morning, Bhante.
And today is May 31st, 2014. Okay, so today we will be taking in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 115. This is called the Bahu Dhatuka Sutta, which means the discourse on the many elements. And the Buddha approaches this topic a little bit indirectly. Since he begins, first he addresses the monks, and then he starts the discourse by drawing a contrast between two types of people. One is called the fool. In Pali, this word is bala, which also means a child, an infant. And it's contrasted with the wise person, which is called pandita. You know, now from this Indian word, it's sort of been absorbed into English. We have the word pundit, which is now used almost in a somewhat derogatory sense, like somebody who thinks he's an expert, usually an expert on national or international affairs. But originally, the word was used in a positive sense, a commending sense, as a person who is learned and wise. And even in India today, one finds people who are called pundits, sometimes they call them panditji, and they're referring to them directly. And these would be like especially learned Brahmins who have mastered the Vedas and the other sacred texts of Hinduism. And so the Buddha begins this discourse by drawing this contrast between the foolish person, the bala, and the wise, the learned, intelligent person, the pandita. So he says, whatever fears arise, fear, I think we should take this more in the objective sense than the subjective sense, whatever dangers arise, all arise because of the fool, not because of the wise man. Whatever troubles arise, all arise because of the fool, not because of the wise man. Whatever calamities arise, all arise because of the fool, not because of the wise man. And then he uses a simile to illustrate the danger of the fool, the dangers that the fool creates. This is like a fire that starts in a shed or a hut made of grasses or reeds. And so once that fire starts, it starts spreading and it burns down all the other types of buildings, even houses with peaked roofs plastered inside and out, secured by bars with shuttered windows. And so whatever dangers arise, all arise because of the fool. Okay, and so the fool brings danger, the fool brings trouble, the fool brings calamity, while the wise person doesn't bring any kind of danger, trouble, or calamity. Okay, so then, from that introduction, the Buddha then says that you should, he's addressing the monks, he says, you should train thus, we shall be wise men, we shall be inquirers, those who make inquiry or investigation. Okay, so then when the Buddha says this, then Ananda brings up the question, how a monk can be called a wise man, how he can be called an inquirer, one who investigates things. And then the Buddha introduces the subject, the main subject of the discourse. He says that for a monk to be a wise man, an inquirer, he should be skilled in the elements, skilled in the bases, skilled in dependent origination, and skilled in what is possible and what is impossible. That is, we call this the matika. This is the almost table of contents, the outline, the sort of list of subjects. And then the rest of the discourse, the Buddha is going to explain and elaborate these particular topics. It's a little bit puzzling to me that in this list of topics, the Buddha doesn't mention here the five aggregates, because one would think that one who's investigating things would also investigate them in terms of the five aggregates. And in so many other suttas, you know, the Buddha enumerates and explains the five aggregates. I don't know why they're not mentioned here, but it's just possible, conceivable, that in other versions of the sutta, which has come down in different lines of transmission, the five aggregates were also mentioned. And maybe somehow they dropped out from the Pali transmission. In any case, we start off with the section on how a monk can be called skilled in the elements. And here the Buddha begins directly with the most common way of classifying things according to the elements. And this is by way of the 18 elements. So the 18 elements, we can arrange these in a very convenient, neat table. Okay, so we have, if we look at the 18 elements, we could see that we can arrange them according to six sense faculties, six what seem to be six types of sense objects, and six types of consciousness. And now, you know, when we see an arrangement like this, we might raise the question, why does the Buddha put so much emphasis on analyzing things into their elements? What would be the purpose of this? Any thoughts? Did I see a little poem?
My guess is that he wants you to see the non-existence of so-called ego.
To see?
Non-existence of ego.
Okay, that's basically along the right track. Because normally we sort of grasp upon the perception of, you know, the constituents of our being. We grasp upon them as being some kind of compact or solid whole in the technical language of Buddhism. We call this sometimes pindagaha. Grasping upon a mass, an accumulation, a pile of phenomena, and taking them to be some kind of solid entity, solid substantial entity. And based upon this grasping of the whole, there arises the idea of the self, the ego, some kind of truly existing I, the basis for the thought, the notion, I am. And then when we grasp the I, the ego, then there comes an identification of the ego with body, feelings, perceptions, and so forth. And so then we become attached to the sense of I. And from the sense of I comes the sense of mine, what belongs to me. And for the Buddha, this is the sort of manifestation or solidification of ignorance, sort of the way our world becomes constellated into a field in which the center is the ego, the I, the self. And everything is seen to depend upon the self and to revolve around the self. So the self then becomes the center of this, of experience, the center of the universe. And so what the Buddha does is to put a kind of microscope onto this pinda, this lump, this mass, this collection that we identify as being I or myself, and inquire what is actually there. And when we look into that mass, that assemblage, one finds that it's actually a combination of components, sometimes analyzed into the five aggregates. But here, the emphasis here, the analysis is in terms of the 18 elements. And so I would say that if we compare the five aggregates with the 18 elements, what kind of difference do we see? How would we maybe explain the difference between them? I assume everybody knows what the five aggregates are. I see everybody is nodding like this. Sometimes one has to check up because Heads might nod like this out of habit. Can anybody enumerate the five aggregates in the correct sequence?
Form, feeling, perception, mental formation, and concept.
Okay, very good. Excellent. Okay, so we have form, material form, feeling, perception, the mental formations, sometimes called volitional formations, and consciousness. Okay, now compare with the 18 elements, 6 sense faculties or sense organs, 6 sense objects, 6 types of consciousness. And what kind of difference do we see?
It occurred to me that this is, in a way, an answer to why doesn't he talk about the 5 aggregates,
yeah.
That I saw it as a microscope that's looking even closer.
Okay, that's a good point.
That you see the tinier pieces.
Okay, that's a good point.
You can talk about the 5, or you can really
That's a good point.
The 18.
Yeah, so she says that she sees the 18 elements as being a kind of finer analysis of the factors that are brought in under the 5 aggregates. Any other ideas? And when I ask this question, I don't have in my mind the idea there's a right answer, and I'm testing whether to see whether you get the right answer. But just express your own sort of understanding of what the difference might be. What is your name, by the way?
Oh, Hector.
Hector.
Yes.
Okay.
The difference that I see is that this lists the sense object, where within the aggregates, I don't see the sense object. Obviously, it's there.
Yeah. And so we have sense objects, and not only sense objects, but what else do we have not mentioned specifically in the 5 aggregates?
I think it's feelings.
Excuse me?
Feelings.
We have this. Oh, I see. Feelings mentioned in the aggregates.
Yes, and it's not here.
Yeah, but let's take it from this standpoint. What do we see in the 18 elements? Since Hector said he sees the sense objects mentioned, what do we see in the elements that we don't see mentioned specifically in the aggregates?
Faculties.
Right, the sense faculties, and we know that 5 of the sense faculties are material phenomena. The eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body sense. And of the sense objects, we have visible form, visible form, sound, odors, tastes, and tactile objects. And those also come under the aggregate of form. So we could say that here we have at least 10 factors, 10 elements belong to the aggregate of form. Okay, another difference between the scheme of the 18 elements and the scheme of the 5 aggregates. Taking it from the angle of the elements looking to the aggregates. The answer, it's already on the board. Maybe my question isn't phrased precisely.
Consciousness.
So how do you express the difference? You got it right, but let's get a more precise statement.
The awareness of the objects through the senses.
Okay, when we have the aggregates, We say just the consciousness aggregate, just one, right? But here we have six types of consciousness, right? So we could say that there's a finer analysis of consciousness. So consciousness aggregate. Then becomes at least six elements, maybe seven. Okay, now looking from the aggregates to the elements, what we find in the aggregates that we don't find mentioned specifically in the elements. Well, this is just a simple, like a logical question, using logical sets.
I think it is perceptions and feelings.
And?
Mental volition.
Yeah, we have three aggregates. Feeling aggregate, perception aggregate, mental formations or volition aggregate, which are not specifically mentioned under the 18 elements. But the 18 elements are supposed to comprehend everything. So that means that those three aggregates have to fit someplace within the 18 elements. Where would they fit? This is a little tricky question.
Is it a mental faculty?
The what?
The mental faculty.
The mind faculty.
Yeah, the mind faculty.
No, no.
Would it be mind consciousness?
No. Yeah, this is a hard one to get. But this is the way sort of the Abhidhammikas, you know, the masters of the, or the teachers of the Abhidhamma, the formulators of the Abhidhamma did it. It seems, you know, when you look at this, it seems that mental phenomena, which is in Pali, Dhamma, Dhatu, when you see the parallel columns, it seems that mental phenomena should be the objects of mind consciousness. Just like forms are the object of eye consciousness, sounds are the object of ear consciousness, odors are the object of nose consciousness, and so on. So it would seem sort of logical to infer that the Dhamma Dhatu, the mental phenomena, are simply the objects of mind consciousness, which is called Mano Vijnana Dhatu, the mind consciousness element. But this left the problem, if that were the case, it would leave the problem, where does feeling, perception, and the volitional mental activities fit in? They're not actual mind element, they're not actual mind consciousness element, because those are factors associated with the mind, not mind itself. So the Abhidhamma teaches, put feeling, perception, and mental formations under the heading of Dhamma Dhatu, the mental phenomena. So the mental phenomena doesn't mean only the objects of mind consciousness, but it's both objects of mind consciousness and the factors that arise associated with consciousness, that is, feeling, perception, and mental formations. I know it's a little confusing, but when I was starting to study Chinese with a woman named Sharon Chi, sometimes when I would come across some phrase in Chinese, I didn't understand how this was to be understood syntactically, or the exact sense of the idiom, she would just say, "Oh, that's the way they say it in Chinese." So if you're puzzled by this, I just have to say, that's the way the teachers of the Abhidhamma classified it. Okay, now, something a little sort of puzzling is, what is the relationship here between mind and mind consciousness? And what is meant by mind, and what is meant by mind consciousness? Okay, if we take, let's take the parallel case with the eye. Okay, we know what the eye is, and we know what eye consciousness is, that there's a kind of consciousness that arises based on the eye, especially the inner parts of the eye, which have the functions of receiving light and sort of transforming light into signals. In modern physiology, maybe the rods and cones which take the light, change them into colors, or at least the physical components of colors, counterparts of colors, transmit it through the ocular nerve to certain regions of the brain where it becomes perceived as colors. Okay, so we know what the eye is, or let's say the whole visual apparatus. We know what colors are, and we know that eye consciousness is a type of consciousness that arises based on the visual apparatus and that sees colors. Sees forms, colors, and shapes. So what is mind here? One might think, well, the mind must be the physical basis of consciousness. But that's not the way the teachers of the exponents of the Dhamma explain it. And in the suttas themselves, one doesn't find an explicit definition of mind and mind consciousness and the drawing of a relationship between them, which is a bit puzzling. It's all puzzled me for decades. Why one never sees like a monk come to the Buddha and say, "Bhante, you're always talking about mano, mind, and mano vijnana, mind consciousness. What are they? What is the relationship between them?" But one never sees that question brought up. It's always just, "Yes, Bhante, Ama Bhante, Ama Bhante, Evam Bhante, Evam Bhante." But then, it seems that this question got decided or really treated analytically only when we come to the age of the Abhidhamma, where in the Pali Abhidhamma system, the mind element becomes identified with I don't want to drive you out halfway through the class, but becomes identified with three particular occasions of mental activity within the process of cognition. One of these phases is what is called the five-door adverting consciousness. This is the consciousness that arises, the momentary citta, or active consciousness that arises when an object impinges on one of the sense faculties. So a visible form sort of strikes against the eye, or a sound impinges on the ear. Now before, in the case of the visible form, before the eye consciousness arises, seeing the form, there arises just one moment of mind in which the mind sort of is swinging like back and forth. There's a very vague recognition that something is impinging on a sense faculty. Which sense faculty is it? And it's sort of swinging among the sense faculties until it fixes on the form. So this is called the five-door adverting consciousness, because the five doors are the five sense doors: eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and body. And then when an object impinges, this consciousness sort of arises and says, which door is being knocked on? And then if it recognizes it's a form knocking on the eye door, then eye consciousness will arise. But if it's a sound impinging on the ear, then ear consciousness will arise. This is a little bit like, suppose you have a house with five doors. The door to the north, north, east, south, west. And where else do we have a door?
Attic.
Yeah.
Other door.
The attic, but people won't approach the building unless something. Unless you're emitting vampires that fly through the sky. Somebody said another idea? Oh yeah, maybe somebody has an entrance through the garage. Okay, so you're sitting in your living room or your study in the middle of the house, then there comes a knocking on the door. And so you pick up your head from what you're doing and you wonder what door is being knocked on. And you listen again, and then the person will knock. Then you recognize, it's the front door, it's the back door, one of the side doors. And you go to the door and you answer it. And so that is called the five-door adverting consciousness. Then immediately after the five-door adverting consciousness, there will arise the sense consciousness. That will be either the eye consciousness, seeing the form, the ear consciousness, hearing the sound, and so on. And then immediately after the sense consciousness, there arises one type of consciousness that, it said, receives the object. Its simple function is just to accept the object, sort of to take it in. I don't know how to explain this more simply. But maybe if we use an analogy, analogies are always imperfect, but it's like you're playing ball with somebody, and then somebody throws you the ball, then you catch it, maybe catching the ball, the moment the ball comes into the grip of your hands, that is like the sense consciousness. And then the next moment, you just fasten your grip on the ball, and that is like the receiving consciousness, which just receives the object.
Would that be like going from seeing to looking, or hearing?
Not quite. The looking would come at a still later stage. Okay. It's a good question.
Okay.
But this is, we have to understand that these are like very rapid moments of consciousness, just, you know, fleeting by, they say, hundreds of times in the snap of a finger. So it just has this very simple function of receiving the object. And then they'll come, receiving. Then there comes a consciousness called investigating. Maybe the investigating consciousness would be like the initial moment of looking. And then there comes something called the determining consciousness, where one determines the nature of the object that one has received or accepted. And so the Abhidhamma teaches then identify the mind element with the five door inverting and the receiving. But that is the Abhidhamma way of explanation. In the suttas, as I said, it's not analyzed or not made explicit. So my assumption would be probably at the level of the sutta discourse, the mind element is conceived just as some kind of faculty responsible for, let us say, for directing the attention to the object, on the basis of which mind consciousness will then arise clearly and clearly and clearly and determinately perceiving or cognizing the object. Okay, I'll repeat that again. This is sort of my interpretation, would be that at the level of sutta explanation, the mind element would be simply a faculty or a mental function that directs the attention to the object coming in, and that serves as the basis for mind consciousness to arise and clearly determine the nature of the object that's been perceived or cognized. Clearly and distinctly, yeah, that's the Cartesian terms. Richard?
Yes, so then...
Do we have the floating mic? Do we have the mobile microphone here?
Kind of better.
Okay, anyway, you can speak loudly.
So that seems to imply that all of the objects and all of the, you know, all of the functions are really concerned solely with the senses, as that the only thing being cognized, the form, are senses. In that case, I was expecting mind consciousness to be something about introspection, about consciousness of one's own thoughts.
Okay.
Where does that fit?
Actually, that's a good point. And all of that kind of activity, reflective activity, introspective activity, emotional reactions to the objects perceived, planning, launching projects in the world and so forth, all of that would take place within the domain of mind consciousness.
Oh, so it's included.
Yeah, it's very inclusive, mind consciousness. Its task is not only to determine the nature of objects that are impinging on the field of awareness. That is sort of like the elementary level of cognition. But then built upon that, within the realm of mind consciousness, all the more sophisticated mental functions will take place.
Under sense faculty, comes the chakku-vijnana for the eye consciousness?
No.
Eye faculty, not it.
Yeah, under the sense faculty comes only eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. Excuse me?
The sixth one would be the mind.
The sixth one is mind, or what's in terms of elements, it's dhamma, manodhatu. I'm sorry, I should have put it. That, this one is manodhatu. Which is mind element. And then that is contrasted with mano, with mind consciousness element, which is mano vijnana dhatu. Yeah, so we have to be careful to recognize that the faculties, at least with the senses, are the physical sense faculties themselves, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. And those are distinct from the consciousnesses
that
are.
The sixth one would be mana.
Yeah, the sixth faculty is the mano dot. The sixth faculty is the mano dhatu, and its object is dhamma dhatu. Then, based on these two, we have mind consciousness element, mano. Then, jnana dhatu.
So does that mean the eye faculty would be chakku dhatu?
Yeah. Chakku dhatu, the ear would be sota dhatu. Form, visible form would be rupa dhatu. Sound would be sadda dhatu, and so on. Was there some other question on? Yeah.
Is dangerous or not?
Oh.
Is it the mind consciousness or the mind receiving?
No, that would be the work of a pretty advanced stage of mind consciousness. Okay. The way, I mean, this isn't dealt with in the suttas, you know, it's not, we don't find like detailed analysis like this in the suttas, which have a more practical orientation. And even in the old layer of the Abhidhamma, we don't find analysis like that. But the later teachers of the Abhidhamma, particularly I think this could have developed in Burma, by the Abhidhamma teachers in Burma, even 18th, 19th century, have developed like very complex explanations of how the different stages of cognition unfold, one based on another. So even to recognize an object, for me to recognize this as a cup, for example, what has to take place? First, there's the visual perception. Then based on the visual perception, which would be a process occurring through the eye consciousness, then there would take place a mind consciousness by which I determine clearly the shape, color of this. Then there will be a number of layers or phases of cognition by which are occurring very, very quickly, so I'm not even aware of them, by which the mind compares this impression with that of similar impressions of things that have been used before as a cup, and then determines, based on that, comes to a definite, clear, and distinct cognition, this is a cup. And then it's even more sophisticated, say, I look in this cup, I see like a pale yellow, and this one is a reddish brown. So when I look at these simultaneously, it's a pretty sophisticated operation. First to determine the difference in the colors, then to infer this is probably a Chinese oolong tea, whereas this can be either a Ceylon type of tea, or Indian type of tea, or a herbal tea. And then to wonder, what exactly is this? You know, all of that is sort of later stages of mind consciousness following upon the initial sense consciousness. And finally, curiosity overcomes me. a herbal tea, but I can't place the flavor, so my mind is sort of going back and comparing with previous impressions of this flavor. I can't quite get it. What is it?
Honey bush.
Honey bush. So now I have an impression of honey bush, so if I get that tea on a later occasion, I'll be able to compare. And then if something is dangerous, then there'll be like still later stages of mental processing where, okay, say a dog is running after me, barking, then you know, I compare with previous impressions of dogs that have run after me barking. Some, when they get up to me, wag their tail and start, you know, sniffing in a friendly way. Others have bitten me.
Bande, how early can a yoniso manasikara happen? That this is a cup, it's beautiful, but it's not mine. So I have greed. So how early can it happen?
It would actually probably, that kind of a yoniso manasikara, which leads to greed, would come in mind consciousness at a fairly, I would say, a somewhat later stage. But I think the Abhidhammika teachers would say that the ayoniso, this is the unwise attention, comes in at an early stage. They would say that. Though it seems to me, since I think more at the level of practical orientation rather than the fine theoretical analysis. But we could see how, maybe if we pay close attention to the working of our mind, that even that unwise attention slips in almost unconsciously at a very early stage. Like when I see maybe that the neighbor has a new car that I don't have, fancy it. I'm just driving a Toyota and he pulls in a Mercedes or Jaguar. Or I'm using a Dell computer and the person sitting next to me, I see they pull their computer out of their computer sack and it's a Macintosh with all of the latest fancy programs. That's not a hint because I can't use a Macintosh. Any other questions so far at this point? Shall we go on then to the next? Okay, so then the Buddha says, when he knows and sees these 18 elements, a monk can be called skilled in the elements. Okay, now since the Buddha already sort of mentioned a number of ways in which a monk can be called a wise man, an inquirer, we're still in relation to the elements. So Ananda then asks, could there be another way in which a bhikkhu can be called skilled in the elements? And so now the Buddha says that there is, and then he says that there are six elements. Here we have the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element. When he knows and sees these six elements, a monk can be called skilled in the elements. Okay, this is a very concise explanation of the six elements, but we can find a more detailed analysis of at least the first five elements if we turn back to sutta number 62. This would be on page 528. Okay, here the Buddha is speaking to his son, his biological son, Rahula, who's probably at this stage an adolescent, maybe 17, 18 years old, and he's explaining to him how to meditate on the elements. And so he explains now the earth element, whatever, in this on 528, paragraph 8, whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. And then he mentions, I think it's 19 or 20 components of the body which are considered solid, hard and solid. Hairs of the head, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, and the various organs, the kidneys, heart, lungs, spleen, intestines, and so on. So this is taken as representative of the earth element. Then we have the water element. What is the water element? Whatever is so that's the internal water element. And then the external element would be any kind of external objects that are solid, hard, and so on. Okay, what is the water element? The water element might be internal or external. The internal water element is whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery or liquid, and clung to. So then he mentions a number, I think there are 12 liquid parts of the body, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, and so on, down to the oil of the joints and urine. And then there's the external water element, any kind of external liquid. The fire element, or heat element, okay, is again internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery, and clung to. And then I think 6 aspects, or is it 4 aspects of the fire element are mentioned. That by which one is warmed, so that's the bodily heat, normally around 98 degrees Fahrenheit. That by which one ages and is consumed. This was the Indian physiological belief that heat causes the body to grow old. Maybe an example of this outwardly is that if you have a fruit, an apple or banana, well, bananas we don't refrigerate, apple or pear, and we keep it outside, or better, mango, okay, an apple or a mango, we keep it outside, where it gets exposed to the heat, then it starts to wither, to dry up, and to go bad. But if we refrigerate the apples and the mangoes and the papayas and the grapes, then they will be preserved for a long time. So the heat element is what's causing them to deteriorate, to age. And then that by which what one eats, drinks, consumes, gets digested. That is the digestion, what actually causes the agent of digestion is the hydrochloride in the stomach acid, and that digests the food, it burns up the food. In fact, burning up the food, it's a process of digesting the food, of oxidation. And oxidation is exactly the same as consumption by heat. So that's the internal fire element, and then there's the external fire element. Not only burning fires, but the heat present in the atmosphere, the heat coming from the sun, any kind of heat in external objects. And then there's the air element or wind element, and the internal air element, the Buddha says, is whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to, that is, upgoing winds, downgoing winds. So these are the winds that go through the body. And in the ancient Indian physiology, it seems that the what we would now call nerve impulses, neurological impulses, were interpreted as the movement of the air element through the body. You know, so we have upgoing winds, those might be interpreted as, there's the distinction is made between motor neurological impulses, those which are responsible for movement, and then sensory neurological impulses, those responsible for sensations. And then there are winds or air in the belly, as we know when we belch, winds in the bowels, of course, which we know when we fart, and then the winds that course through the limbs. And then the most obvious would be in-breathing and out-breathing. And then externally, there's the movement, there's the air, and its movement is seen most distinctly in the wind. Okay, this is a sort of, we call this a detailed and very concrete way of explaining the four material elements. But according to the Buddhist like philosophical analysis, the four elements are actually somewhat metaphorical terms which represent properties of matter that are said to be present in every material object, every material particle. And so what's called the earth element is identified with the property of, call it resistance or extension, the property by which matter occupies space and resists the encroachment of other material particles. So, though at the level of ordinary discourse, ordinary way of speaking, we would distinguish, say, the solid table as being representative, representing the earth element, and we would say that the tea represents the water element or the liquid element. We know that within the liquid of the tea there are particles, atoms, and if we which have nuclear subatomic particles and so on. So if we compress the tea, at a certain point, it will go down, 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 but at a certain point there'll be resistance. If we put enough pressure, it will solidify. And so this illustrates that even the earth element is present in a liquid. Or if we drop the temperature of water or tea in a freezer, if we put the water in the freezer, it turns into ice. So this would demonstrate that the earth element is already present in water. And then any kind of material body above absolute freezing, absolute zero, has some degree of heat. You know, even when we go outside in the winter, we say that the ice is really cold, the weather is really cold, but if you were to go to Siberia in the winter and then come back to New York State, you would say it's balmy and comfortable. Or even, not to speak of Siberia, in the Midwest this past winter, temperatures were down 40 degrees below zero. And here in New York State, when the temperature was 10 degrees, we were saying, oh, it's absolutely freezing, I can't go out today. But if you took a plane from Indiana or Iowa to New York and got out, it would put on your swimming swimsuit and say, where is the swimming pool? 10 degrees, perfect, the perfect day for the beach. Okay, and then in matter, there's always even the cup that seems to be standing still. You know, it seems to be hard and solid, but there's some movement of the particles. You know, if we had this vision like an electron microscope, so that we could look at the ceramic material of the cup really in fine detail, we would see a whole bunch of molecules, you know, running around, moving around, vibrating in constant motion. So that constant vibration and motion, that's supposed to be illustrate the presence of the air element or wind element. And so when we could use this analysis in terms of the property of matter to attend to the body itself, in fact, this is what's done with the four element meditation. One way to do it is by analyzing the body into the different constituents, the way the Buddha does when he's speaking to Rahula. But another way is to focus upon the distinctive qualities of each of the material elements, so we can tune into and discern the earth element by way of the two properties, sort of contrasting properties of hardness and softness. So hardness is the prominence, indicates prominence of the earth element, whereas softness indicates the, call it the subordinate role of the earth element, or weakness of the earth element. So hardness and softness are both representing the earth element. Then when we attend to the body sort of meditatively in contemplation, one could get a sense of the, on the one hand, of the flowing of substances through the body. And also it's explained, this is in the Abhidhamma way of explanation, that the water element or liquid element has the property of cohesion, of binding together. So the water element is what functions a little bit like the atomic cement that holds the particles of the earth element together into one distinct entity. I think in nuclear physics, they speak about a subatomic particle called the gluons, which are said to be responsible for holding the quarks together, or they hold the protons. My science knowledge has gotten so rusty. Protons and neutrons together, hold them together in the nucleus of an atom. So maybe here we could see the gluons as sort of modern counterpart of the water element in the sense of cohesion or binding. And then one attends to the body, focusing upon, especially upon the heat in the body, but also on the contrast between heat and coldness in the body. And so sometimes the body will feel warm, sometimes cold. And one could, as the attention becomes sharpened and mindfulness more precise, one could experience this heat and coolness through the entire body, scanning the body for the heat and cool. And then the air element can be attended to by focusing especially on the in and out breathing, not doing mindfulness of breathing, this is the element meditation, but as one is breathing in and out, one notices that as one is breathing in, one notices that the whole body tends to expand, and one could even feel the sensation of expansion down in the belly, the buttocks, even the legs and the feet. And as one breathes out, one could feel the sensation of contraction, not only in the chest, but in the belly, the buttocks, the legs, the feet. And again, as one attends even more finely, one could get the sense of constant motion of particles throughout the whole body. So in this way, one is observing the work, the operation of the air element. Then there's the space element. When the Buddha speaks to Rahula, this is on page 529. He says that the space element may be internal or external. Then the internal space element is whatever is internal, belonging to oneself, is space, spatial, and clung to. And here the space element is taken to be those parts in relation to the body, those parts of the body which are not apparently occupied by the other elements. So he says the holes of the air, the holes of the ears, the nostrils, the mouth, then that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed. That would be the esophagus, or what we call the gullet. And then where it collects, that would be the empty space of the stomach. Then where it's excreted from below, that would be the empty space in the anus. So it seems that those areas are occupied by an air element. Okay, so that's the internal space element, and then all unoccupied space externally would be the external space element. Okay, so that takes care of the five elements. And then in this sutta, the discourse on many elements, the Buddha mentions also the consciousness element. And here, the consciousness element, probably, again, though it's not analyzed in the text, but we would say that it includes all of the six types of consciousness mentioned in the 18 elements. All six types of consciousness, and probably the mind element as well. So we would say that seven types of consciousness, the six types of discerning consciousness, and the mind element go into the consciousness element. Of course, that leaves the question open, what happens to feelings, perceptions, the mental formations? Any ideas? I don't have a clear answer myself, so don't hesitate to. Consciousness element, the feeling, perception, volitional activities, aggregates, where would they go in relation to the six elements?
They
seem to be mental phenomena. They're processes that occur mentally.
They are, but where would we put them in relation to the...
In the mental phenomena.
No, now we're not... we're taking the six elements.
The consciousness.
Okay, that's one possible answer. There's another possible answer I could think of.
Sense object.
What?
Sense object.
But here we don't have sense objects. Now we just have... Don't pay attention to this board. We're thinking only in terms of six elements. Certainly feeling, perception, volitional activities, they're not earth, not water element, not heat element, not air element, not space element. So one answer is to see them included sort of implicitly in the consciousness element. The other answer, maybe this is my sort of guess, is that the scheme of the six elements doesn't have to be seen as all-inclusive. So maybe it just doesn't include those three aggregates, feelings, perceptions, mental formations. Maybe they're just not included within that scheme. But I like to see the six as being all-inclusive. So it's like when you... And if you buy a computer, then they throw in a sort of a bundle package. They'll give you a, you know, even though it's technically it's not part of the computer itself, but with the package they'll give you a antivirus program. Maybe they'll throw in Microsoft Office, a simple kind of page layout program, you know, for making simple page design. I don't know whether they do that in the U.S., but I remember when we used to buy computers in Sri Lanka, they would throw in, because the prices were rather extravagant, but they tell you, look what you're getting. You're getting Microsoft Office, you're getting those days they didn't give antivirus programs. You're getting Microsoft Office, we're giving you a sort of outdated version of, in those days, it was Aldus PageMaker and some other programs. And so you think you're getting a real bargain. Okay, so we could see feeling, perception, volitional activities, aggregates bundled along with the mental computer, the consciousness element.
Would it be wrong to see feeling is not an element here? Feeling actually is the relationship between the four elements?
One might say it in that way. But it's just, you know, it's not dealt with explicitly in the text. Any other questions on this? Shall we try it? Let's see. I think we could get in another group of elements. I'm going to do something rather daring and drastic right now. If you wanted to preserve this for review, I'll work my way down. Is this getting boring, by the way? I don't want to bore people. Sometimes I think it might be too. People think, oh, this early Buddhism, just so much analysis and classification. Let me go to Zen. Yeah, the monk asked the Zen master, does the dog have a Buddha nature? And the master says, woof! And then you just, you know, so interesting. Why does he say what? Rather than Are the legs the dog? Is the head the dog? The tail the dog? The stomach the dog? Does the dog have the earth element, water element, air element, fire element? Go back to Southeast Asia. Okay, so Ananda asks whether there could be another way that one is skilled in the element. And now the Buddha speaks about six elements: the pleasure element, the pain element, the joy element, the grief element, the equanimity element, and the ignorance element. So these are six elements, and when one knows and sees these six elements, then one is called skilled in the elements. So here we just seem to have an enumeration of six elements, but there's a relationship between these elements. Five of these elements belong to the category of feeling. And so we have, can somebody read them, the list, because I don't have to go back and forth. The order of the shape.
Pleasure
first. Next.
Pain.
Okay.
Joy.
Joy.
Grief.
Okay, grief. Maybe. I'm not so sure that I like grief as a remedy. Well, let's just call it sadness. It's grief is too strong. We just call it. Because dominasa can include, it's like a whole range of feelings. Grief is really the extreme of sorrow. But even if one is feeling a little off, a little upset about something, that's also included here. Then what remains is equanimity. Then the last one is not the feeling, but it's mentioned here anyways, this ignorance. Now most often, the Buddhist texts mention these five together. It's very unusual. I think this might be the only place, it's the only place that I know of where ignorance is added to this list. But these five are five types of feeling. And these five come in certain sets. Pleasure and joy are both aspects of pleasant feeling. The difference is that pleasure is a bodily feeling. Whereas joy is a mental feeling. But this has to, I have to qualify this a bit and point out that all feeling is actually a mental factor, but pleasant feeling, if it occurs through the body, with the body as the basis, for example, on a nice warm day, I'm lying in the grass and there's a cool breeze blowing, then the body feels pleasure, or with a sensual caress, that's a bodily pleasant feeling. Where I lie down on a soft bed when I'm tired, then there comes a pleasant bodily feeling. So the bodily feelings, the feeling itself is a mental event, but this mental event is based on bodily sensations. Whereas what's called somanasa, joy, is called a mental feeling. This is a feeling that arises, say if I see a friend that I haven't seen in a long time, then I'm happy. Or somebody praises me, then I feel happy. Or somebody invites me to go out for a nice meal, then I feel happy. Or I win the lottery, then my troubles start, from what I've heard from those who win lotteries. Okay, so you get the idea, the distinction here. Okay, then the same distinction applies to these two feelings. So these are both painful feelings. But what's called pain here is bodily. So I sit down and there's a thumbtack on the chair that I wasn't aware of. I get a sharp pain. Or after I'm lying out in the sun for a while, the sun gets really hot and then the body starts to get pain from the sunburn maybe. Or that fresh breeze brings in a downpour of rain, and then I get the unpleasant sensation of getting wet by the sudden downpour of rain. Or the weather changes, and what happens to many people, they get arthritis pains, headache, or other sensations. So all of these are bodily pains. And then the mental pain I go in for work and the boss says, I want to speak to you for a moment. And then he says, I'm sorry, but we have to downsize. You're out of here. Or some student stands up and says, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just making pretense of being learned. Then I get upset. Okay, so these are feeling, any kind of feeling of, could be sadness, disappointment, or a good friend departs, so then I feel, then he maybe moves to California or to Europe, then I feel sad, just separation from dear ones. So any kind of mental displeasure, mental unhappiness is dominasa. And strangely, you know, it would seem to me, and I don't want to criticize the Buddha, but it would seem that equanimity could also have been divided into two categories, and I don't know why this hasn't come down in the text. Always they just have five with equanimity put all together. But you know, if we just use a little reflection, we could have had two kinds of equanimous in different feeling, bodily and mental. So the bodily would be just, you know, I just come into a room, it's just a very plain room, there's nothing special. So my feeling is that of equanimity based on the sense perception.
Could it be that this is why ignorance is here, because equanimity is being used in the bodily sensation and ignorance is being used for the mental?
I'm not so sure, because elsewhere, as I said, we find just the five kinds of feelings. You know, so still, you know, in the other passages, if equanimity, if ignorance was not there, the question would still come up, why is an equanimity divided into two kinds?
Yeah, I mean the whole set, everything is yep. Sixes.
Oh, maybe that's the reason.
See, that they threw in ignorance in order to have something equivalent to equanimity that's mental.
But not everything is sixes. We have 18, we have then 6, then we have a 6, then we have a 6, then a 3. Of course, you could say that everything is a multiple of 3s. I don't know, actually. But in any case, it seems on reflection that one could divide equanimity into two kinds, that which is related to the body. I think I know why, but it gets a bit technical. Okay, but let's just say, okay, or I'm walking through and there's just this ordinary sound, I'm walking down the street, the ordinary sound of just traffic, no screeching of tires or honking of horns, but just occasional cars going by, the sound of people maybe as they pass them chatting. So there's no particular happiness or sorrow or sadness on my part because of those perceptions.
After 18, then all the 6s, then 3, then 4, then 2. Is it possible that this is being, that the scheme is being drawn from the number series? You know, there are 2 of these, 4 of those, and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, some of them.
With the number series. And
I mean, definitely the usual sets are drawn from familiar number sets. The 18 elements, 6 elements, then below we'll come across the 12 sense bases. So those are familiar sets. This one, the only thing I could think of, as you said, is that maybe ignorance was added in order to have another neat sixfold set. But normally we have these five types of feeling occurring separately. Particularly we find them in Samyutta Nikaya in the chapter on faculties. They're called, that's chapter 48 of the Samyutta Nikaya. That's the chapter on faculties. So these are called 5 faculties of feeling. And then ignorance is added here, and the reason why, according to the commentary, why ignorance is put in here, it said that ignorance is similar to equanimity or a counterpart of equanimity. And there's some little statement in another sutta which throws some light on this. This would be sutta number 44. Page 403. This is a dialogue between the nun, a bhikkhuni named Dhammadina, and a layman whose name is Visakha. So Visakha asks Dhammadina, what is the counterpart of pleasant feeling? And she says, painful feeling is the counterpart, or in this case, the opposite of pleasant feeling. Then what is the counterpart of painful feeling? Then the answer is pleasant feeling. So those two are direct opposites. But then he asks, what is the counterpart of neither painful nor pleasant feeling? Now, neither painful nor pleasant feeling is another term for equanimous feeling. And then she says, ignorance is the counterpart of neither pleasant nor of neither painful nor pleasant feeling. And I think the reason for this is that this neither painful nor pleasant feeling, or the feeling of equanimity, tends to lull a person into a state of complacency, where one doesn't recognize the impermanence and unsatisfactoriness of this peaceful, neutral feeling. And then one gets sort of swept away by it. I think we're going to have to stop now and break for lunch. We can come back at, let's say 12, since we have to walk up and walk down, let's give it 12:20. We'll come back after lunch, and then we could bring up any points for discussion, any further questions. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. By the way, before I do that, which do you like better? This, the library room here, or the Guanyin Hall for holding the class? Let's see. Who prefers the Guanyin Hall? Who prefers the library? Oh, we have to take account?
I got two. Well, I think I represent someone from the internet. The acoustic is better here.
That's the acoustics. Okay. Those who favor the library? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I think I got those who favor the Guanyin Hall. Put up high so I could see everybody. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4. Up high, high, high. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I guess the library is carrying. Is there anything we could do to make the library comparable to Guanyin Hall for those people who prefer Guanyin Hall? Maybe we discuss later. Maybe something can be done to improve.
I think the reason we prefer Guanyin is that it's easier to get to lunch and back, and we need a walker or transportation problems.
I see. We'll discuss and see if what can be done. Okay, so let us share. I should have done that a little bit earlier. So let us share the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the nagas, the buddhas, wishing them to be well and happy, to protect the Buddha Dharma, to protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Eta vatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha sanya sanyino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhuting. Okay, we end with three bows to the Buddha. The three half bows.
Dr. Bumpton.